This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. In 1927, Charles Lindbergh climbed into the Spirit of St. Louis, took off from Roosevelt Field in New York, and landed 33 and a half hours later on an airfield in Paris. Lindbergh won more than just a place in history. He was competing for and won the Orteig Prize, a $25,000 jackpot given to the first aviator to complete a transatlantic flight. Today, private citizens are trying out their wings in pursuit of another purse. This time, the pot of gold is a lot sweeter, but of course, then again, the goals are literally a lot higher. Be the first to fly your vehicle, which can hold up to three people, fly it 62 miles above the Earth into space. Do this twice in 14 days, and you can claim the $10 million XPRIZE. The organizers of the XPRIZE hope the prize will do for commercial space travel what Lindbergh's flight did for commercial aviation: open it up to the masses. Government-sponsored space trips to the moon and to space station have opened up space travel to just a few multimillionaires. So the vast majority of us will never get there if we wait for NASA, Ariane, the Chinese, Japanese, or Russians to take us. Some big names with deep pockets have entered this commercial race for space. Take Burt Rutan, who designed the only airplane to circle the globe in 1986 on one tank of gas. His Spaceship One was flight-tested just last month in the Mojave Desert, according to XPRIZE officials. The details have been kept secret. Of course, this is a race, after all. Or how about Jeff Bezos? Yes, the same guy, the CEO of the internet company Amazon.com. Not content to hawk books and tchotchkes on a website, Bezos, according to Newsweek, is using his dot-com millions to develop space tourism, reportedly spending $30 million on a reusable spacecraft called New Shepard, named after America's first astronaut, Alan Shepard. Well, how will all of this play out? Is it possible for any private entrepreneur to have deep enough pockets to finance the money pit of space travel? Can the XPRIZE do for space travel what the Orteig Prize did for aviation? This hour, we'll talk about some of the designs that the competing teams are using. We'll also talk about the future of space tourism. What role should the federal government play in regulating space travel? And what would you pay for a few minutes' ride into space? And a bit later in the hour, we'll talk with Ann Drian, wife of the late Carl Sagan, and program director of the Planetary Society's solar sail mission, Cosmos One, another privately funded space project. So give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. If you want to talk about your vision for a future space travel, 1-800-989-TALK. As always, you can surf over to our website for more information. Let me introduce my guests. Edward Hudgens is the editor of the book Space, the Free Market Frontier, published by the Cato Institute. He is an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute and the Washington director of the Objectivist Center. He joins us from our NPR studios in Washington. Thanks for being with us, Dr. Hudgens.
Thanks a lot. How are you doing?
Peter Diamandis is the chairman and president of the XPRIZE Foundation in St. Louis, Missouri. He joins us today from the studios of KUNR on the campus of the University of Nevada in Reno. Thank you for being with us, Dr. Diamandis.
My pleasure.
Tell us about the XPRIZE. Why did you start the XPRIZE?
Well, I've wanted to travel into space since I was 9 years old, and the options right now are either $20 million or government employment. There's only been something like 400 people have ever traveled, and the difficulty is that the spaceships don't exist. Mm-hmm. And with that as an issue, I had read the book The Spirit of St. Louis back in 1954, and in that Lindbergh talked about the early aviation prizes, and it hit me that we could use those prizes once again to spark a new generation of spaceships, and one that might take me, my friends, and business folks up into space.
How many contestants, or if that's the right thing to call them, are there now?
We have 24 teams from 7 countries competing, and these are fantastic visionaries. These are people from whether small companies or small groups, literally garage spaceship builders who have the vision and believe they can do something low cost and safe and go after the $10 million, but more importantly, go after opening a billion-dollar industry.
Edward Hudgens, you got your money on any one of these people?
Well, I think Bert Rutan is probably the front runner at the moment, since he did do a rollout about a month ago. But I think what Peter and his group are doing is exactly the model that needs to replace the government model. I mean, NASA did a good job of getting men to the moon because it had almost unlimited funds. It was absolutely inspiring missions. However, only the private sector can commercialize technology. A lot of people say, well, didn't the government in DARPA and the Pentagon invent the basic technology of the internet? And the answer is true. But who put personal computers on everybody's desk and who hooked everyone up to the internet? It was private commercial companies that figured out how to bring these things to everyone. And so I think that what Peter is doing and the XPRIZE is doing is trying to change the paradigm so that people think of the private sector. People think of we need a space revolution the way we had a computer and telecommunications revolution.
Hmm. Peter, is there any comparison here or any one-on-one with at the prize that Lucky Lindy won? I mean, can you actually think this might start something?
You know, if you look at what the effects of Lindbergh's flight were, they were tremendous. I mean, literally within a year of Charles Lindbergh's flight, the number of pilots tripled in the U.S., number of airplanes quadrupled. More importantly, the number of passengers in the United States went up 30-fold. The year before Lindbergh flew, there were 6,000 people buying tickets. The year after he flew, there were 180,000. Huge. Because people said, my God, if this 25-year-old person can go and do this, then maybe there's an opportunity for me. And beyond that, what happened were the airline stock soared. A huge amount of capital came into the industry. And that's what I'm trying to do here. You know, mm-hmm. We have been living for 40 years with the potential to open up space, which is a trillion-dollar marketplace for all of us. But the key has been bringing the price of transportation down. And right now, the only folks investing in it are the government. You know, the large industries, you know, Lockheed and Boeing, God bless them, they build great stuff, but they wouldn't do it unless it's paid for by the government. And so we need to short-circuit that.
Yeah. Peter, if I could add, in my book, Space, the Free Market Frontier, which the Cato Institute publishes, one of the chapters is by Greg Marinac, who is, I believe, the executive director of the XPRIZE project. And there's quite a list in his chapter of all of the prizes just between the year 1901 and 1913. Most of these private prizes for civil aviation. So there's a good history for anyone interested by Greg Marinac, who also is with the XPRIZE.
So where is the money in this? Is it in space tourism, giving people these short little flights that may last, 4 or 5 minutes of weightlessness and coming back down again? Or is it going to the moon, which is a very expensive proposition? Where as an entrepreneur, where is the money in this to be made?
The money is throughout the entire process. First of all, I mean, the $10 million we offer, it's the largest cash sum ever, mm-hmm. and it's something which people can go and pitch to investors as, you know, we'll return that to you. But the real money is in a couple of places. One, a billion-dollar tourism marketplace, estimated recently at somewhere between $1 and $3 billion per year for suborbital and then eventually orbital flights. But beyond that, you know, what I point out to people is that everything we hold of value on this planet, minerals and metals and real estate and energy, are in near infinite quantities in space. You know, frankly, the things we fight wars over. And we're fighting over these crumbs when we're sitting here in a supermarket filled of resources.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And by the way, you know, it's interesting that there are really two basic motivations. You have to ask the question, how is it in our rational self-interest to become a spacefaring civilization? And there are really two answers. One is indeed the commercial answer, that if you look at what pioneers did in the United States, in what were, you know, then North America, they came in and they made it into, they took the resources that were here that were not being exploited, and they exploited them. The second reason is, as Aristotle said in his Metaphysics, all men by nature desire to know. People who have been interested in space flight since the beginning, like Peter and myself, are inspired. I think, as Ayn Rand said in her essay Apollo 11, she talked about how inspiring the missions were, because they took abstractions like rationality, knowledge, science, etc., and they brought them down to immediate experience. It was the space, the moon landings were a demonstration of the power of the human mind, the power of technology. And I think it's this inspiration and this romance that motivates a lot of people, as well as the profit motive, which is a very good motive indeed.
Well, you see, Go ahead.
I was going to say there's one other major motive that it's we need to keep attention to, and it's, you know, we as a species are an exploring people. It's what brought us from the plains of Africa to every niche on this mm-hmm. planet. But we're living during the most, you know, arguably the most dangerous time of human history, whether it's terrorist activities or whether it's a potential for, you know, an asteroid to come and strike the Earth. We've built so much knowledge, and it is an opportunity for us, our exploits into space, to literally, you know, back up the biosphere for some planetary diversification. Yeah. And it's something that we have to think of as a species.
Are you
absolutely?
Because you're only talking about the XPRIZE for suborbital flights, not multi-day flights. I don't want people to get an impression that they're going to be twirling around space for a few days. Does that mean that that's the limit of space travel that you think commercial space ventures should be involved in? Nothing past. No. Maybe suborbital. Well, how far out, you know, in your marketing plan do you take this? Or in your vision? You go to the moon? Well, go to Mars? Can you pay for that? Can you have deep enough pockets to do that?
Well, you know, I'll answer for Peter and then hear what he has to say. To me, there is no limit. The first step, indeed, is going to be something along the XPRIZE, where someone gets a private rocket that can take three people into space twice in a two-week period. Then you start opening up the tourism part. However, there are a couple of prominent private companies that are working on private space stations, one out in Nevada especially, that's doing exactly this and is going to be close in a couple of years to putting one up. I do foresee private ventures to the moon. The Radio Shack has already contracted with a group called Lunacorp to put a private rover on the moon, and, you know, with all sorts of bells and whistles and lenses and so forth. So to me, it's just a matter of how quickly the expansion goes if we have government regulations out of the way and some other things happening. Literally, I picture in a couple of centuries an enterprise to terraform the planet Mars, to give it an atmosphere so that it will be a second habitat for humanity. You want to talk about a colossal effort, that will be one.
When you say government regulations, I'll have about a minute to the break. Out of the way, is that a hindrance for you to get things going?
Yes, it is. There are two kinds right now.
Tell us what kinds of government.
Number one, launch restrictions. It takes up to 6 months for private companies to get permission to launch rockets, and there's a lot that needs to be done to bring that time down. Number two, a couple of years ago, the approval for exports for space hardware was taken from the Commerce Department and given to the State Department. State Department has been horrible and really hindering a lot of private efforts that are being done with the Russians and the Europeans for American companies. And we really need to revisit those export controls and those other regulations. Plus, some of NASA's purchasing policies have also hindered the private sector.
And for the XPRIZE teams, the greatest regulation is going to be, how do they go and certify their vehicle to sell seats? Because, after all, going up is not enough. We need to make an industry out of it.
All right, we're going to take a short break and come back to Earth for a little bit and talk lots more. I want to also address the question: if you don't have government regulations, how can you assure? I mean, even the federal government and the aviation industry has an FAA, which assures some sort of oversight, you know, to airplanes, some sort of oversight to keeping everybody separated in the traffic and the lanes and the highways that they use in the space. There has to be. We'll talk about it a little bit. There's got to be some sort of coordination if you're going to have a whole bunch of spacecraft taking the highways, the space highways up. So we'll take a short break. We'll come back and talk lots more with Ed Hudgens, author of Space, the Free Market Frontier, published by the Cato Institute. Peter Diamandis is chairman and president of the XPRIZE Foundation in St. Louis. And we'll take your questions. Don't go away. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the private space race with my guests, Edward Hudgens, editor of the book Space, the Free Market Frontier, published by the Cato Institute. Peter Diamandis is chairman and president of the XPRIZE Foundation in St. Louis, Missouri. Let's take a phone call or two before we go on. Let's go to Rick Tomlinson. Hi, Rick Tomlinson. Hi, from L.A. Welcome to Science Friday.
How you doing, Ira?
How are you? Tell everybody who you are, who don't know who you are. Tell them who
Hi,
you
Rick.
Are.
Hi, Rick.
Yeah, well, I'm a friend of Peter and Ed's, and You know, I worked a little bit on Flying Dennis Tito and a little bit on the Mir project, this and that and the other. I mean, you know, what's interesting is a vanishingly small group of us who are crazy enough to do this kind of thing. And right now I'm just trying to win the prize for getting across L.A. in traffic.
You know, it's the old thing. You can send somebody to the moon, but you can't get across town and down.
I know.
Sail over the 405.
Yeah, right. A nice parabolic rocket flight across L.A. would work for me. But
so, Rick, do you have a question or a comment?
Yeah, I wanted to say that it really is the interface between our government and these valiant attempts by all of these incredible people that are taking these shots that's really where the critical landmines lie and the potential gold mines also. And that when we get to things like the regulation, you know, somebody could win the X Prize, for example, and be regulated out of existence. And that's where we're really going to be needing to pay a lot of attention. To have the government work as a partner rather than a competitor with the private sector. And that, I think, is the big change, where we can get away sort of from an elitist government program that at times is even threatened by the private sector, to where we're working hand in hand.
But don't you think there has to be some regulation for perhaps safety, you know, about that, or keeping the rocket spaced apart, you know, like they do for commercial airliners?
Oh, absolutely. Look, I'm on a freeway, and there's a guy in a black and white car who's going to pull me over if I screw up.
Right.
You know, there is an appropriate role for government, but not, shall we say, sort of a socialist dominating, controlling role.
Mm-hmm. You know, the office that does that right now, the Office of Commercial Spaceflight, is part of the FAA, and Patty Smith, who heads that, is really a tremendous friend to the industry and is working very hard with her team to do it. They've got a challenge. You know, we can't afford to regulate this nascent industry as we do a mature 100-year-old aviation industry. Otherwise, we won't get started. And they recognize that fact. But we still have a challenge.
Well, with a conservative, with a conservative president, I would imagine that you should have some friends in the White House.
Well, I think we do. By the way, I would add, in terms of the regulatory issue, that when airlines were deregulated in 1977, at that year, Americans made 275 million flights by plane. In the year 2000, Americans made 650 million flights by plane because the price of flying had gone down that much with deregulation. One of the biggest problems up until the 9-1-1 situation that airlines had was that the airlines operated fine, but the government-owned airports couldn't expand fast enough because of regulations. It literally took less time to put a man on the moon than to build a new runway at the airport. Not because it takes a lot of time to lay cement, but because of the regulatory thing. And the other thing was the FAA, the air traffic control system, is antiquated. The Canadians have actually privatized theirs. Mm-hmm. And the government will still be involved in the safety aspect, but they really have to look at opening things up, because that's what happened with civil aviation.
Mm-hmm. One of the differences to point out, Ira, is that space is not a program, it's a frontier.
Yes.
And we have a very different mindset here. You know, the FAA's hope on air travel is it's 100% safe. You know, we're doing something here that has an element of risk. We're opening a frontier. And, you know, the fact of the matter is it is risky business. But at the same time, as Americans, we have to recognize that risk is something that's inherent in exploring a new frontier, and that we're beneficiaries of 500 years ago, thousands of people risking their lives to cross the Atlantic, and you know, where I live in California, thousands more are risking their lives to cross the Great Plains. And as long as we remember that, then we can judge it accordingly. But when I start hearing from folks out in NASA, you know, that risk is not an option, and that failure is not an option, then we're entering a scenario where we have a hard time redeveloping a robust transportation industry into space.
Right. The best way to ensure that you never have a failure is to never risk anything. But that basically is called stagnation. And as I pointed out, as Ayn Rand points out in her books, as lots of people point out, human beings are explorers. Human beings are risk takers. We're pioneers, okay? Buzz Aldrin, who's doing some very interesting work right now, by the way, on next-generation spacecraft, I think has said that, look, everyone assumed, you know, here's a man who walked on the moon. Everyone assumed that there were going to be deaths, unfortunately, just as there are on the highway and in planes. We don't want that. Mm-hmm. But a risk-free society is impossible.
Mm-hmm. Let me go. Let me bring on another guest. Actually, another competitor for the X Prize, a spokesman for one of the competing teams. Neil Milburn is the federal liaison for Armadillo Aerospace. He joins us by phone from Mesquite, Texas. Welcome to Science Friday.
Well,
hey, Neil.
Appreciate the chance to tell you a little bit about Armadillo. And I was listening in the background there to the other folks talking about the regulatory issues. That's really high on our list of problems to address this coming year.
Well, give us a little thumbnail sketch of what Armadillo is, your project.
Well, Armadillo started out actually just as a group of five or six guys here in the Dallas, Texas area, working on a small project totally unrelated to space access or the XPRIZE at that stage. We were just working on a vehicle that would rocket powered that would hover, lift up, translate, and then and set down again. And it kind of grew from there. We started off with a little vehicle, weighed about 10, 20 pounds, and it grew like Topsy into a vehicle that finally weighed about 500 pounds, and we had a manned flight on it back in September of last year, just a short 10-second hover. And I guess it was about that same time the guys at XPRIZE managed to get the prize fully funded. Before that, I think they had raised about $2 million, and they finally came across this scheme to use an insurance policy to fund the prize totally. And whilst it wasn't on our original radar, we decided, boy, if we can pass go and collect $10 million, that's not a bad thing to do on the way to doing what we wanted to do, which was develop a suborbital vehicle that's capable of both vertical takeoff and powered landings, kind of like the DCX. Mm. And we've been at it hard now for, we started about 3 years ago. We have a scale XPRIZE vehicle that's undergoing powered tests right now. And we have a full-size boilerplate version of the XPRIZE vehicle that we're going to be using for some static testing and do some parachute drop tests in the next 5 or 6 weeks. And the final XPRIZE vehicle should be under construction before the end of the year, and we're looking to fly it out at White Sands Missile Range beginning first quarter of 2004.
Well, White Sands, that's a government proving ground. You'll need cooperation then from the federal government, too.
Yeah, in fact, the biggest problem, I don't think that the technical challenges are going to stop us from reaching space. Our biggest problem is regulatory issues, and both from a launch license standpoint and finding a facility to launch from. And White Sands mm-hmm. appears to us, at any rate, to be the best option for us at the moment.
It's your founder, John Carmack, is very well known in the video game business. It's interesting. For games like Doom and Quake and Wolfenstein, it reminds me of I mentioned at the beginning Jeff Bezos of another .com person. Are these guys are this just hobbies for these people and for Mr. Carmack?
Who it started out as a hobby. That's basically what it was a little hobby project, but it's grown into to a little mini industry. It seems like all those computer guys are all space nuts like us, and I'm glad to say through their work in the computer industry they've raise enough capital to become angels for the access to space, and that's what it takes right now. We've had many meetings about startup companies that all have the same kind of goals of providing cheap access to the masses, but the venture capitalists are just not interested in the market. Too high a risk, and the returns are uncertain. So it takes people like John Carmack and Bezos and Elon Musk to push the frontiers.
How do you decide who's going to be the first to fly on? You're
right. We thought we were going to have an arm wrestling contest, but one of the guys is way bigger than me. we all of us, the group is seven people all told, and we all of us want to fly the vehicle eventually. It'll probably come down to some rather prosaic venture in the end. One of the guys, a fellow by the name of Russ Blink, I think, will actually be the first pilot. He's probably the youngest of the group. He's had skydiving experience. Doesn't have my problems with age and weight, so he'll probably be the first to go.
So do you think having a real shot at the prize?
Yeah, right now, we don't know, obviously, just how far along some of the projects are that we're not directly familiar with. But right now, the general feeling is that it'll either be Burt Rutan or ourselves that stand the best chance of meeting the goal before the end of 2004.
Well, good luck to you, Neil.
Well, we appreciate it, and good luck to all the rest of the XPRIZE competitors out there as well.
Thanks a lot.
See you again soon, Neil.
You bet. Yeah. Bye for now.
Isn't competition great?
Neil, let me just tell everybody that Neil Milburn is the federal liaison for Armadillo Aerospace. And I don't know. I guess everybody keeps saying that Rutan is the leg up on this one.
You know, we have to be careful about that because we have 24 teams. About 12 of them are building hardware actively, and at least 4 or 5 IRA are going to make launch attempts in the next 6 to 7 months. It may not be the full XPRIZE flight, but when we go back in history, you know, Ortega's prize of $25,000 stimulated 9 different teams who spent $400,000. And Admiral Byrd, who had been the first person to fly to the North Pole, was thought to be the absolute, you know, hands-down favorite, and he crashed on takeoff. And here comes this 25-year-old startup, Lucky Lindy, who was the last person you'd expect to win. And if Ortega were a betting man, he would have bet on Lindbergh last, but luckily by putting up a prize, he backed the winner automatically.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phone. Steven in Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Steven.
Hi, how you doing?
Hi.
My question, actually, more of a comment, I guess, really. I'm concerned about orbital debris and the prospect of privatized space travel. It's my understanding that there is now a web of debris around the planet and consisting of things like nuts and bolts, sections of rockets, and pieces of paint that fly at 17,000 miles an hour. And the more we launch, it seems, the more debris we're going to have. So that's a concern of mine as it comes when it comes to space travel. Perhaps we could have a contest to figure out a way to solve this problem.
Well, Stephen, you know, I've got an even better idea. Go ahead, Peter.
Say one person's problem is another person's opportunity. Sounds like a great business opportunity to me.
Indeed.
Yeah, and by the way, I was going to add, there can certainly be businesses who clean up and perhaps use that stuff. But you've raised a very interesting point. It's called the tragedy of the commons. When nobody owns anything, if nobody owns a lake, there's no incentive not to dump stuff in the lake or to overfish the lake, right? If somebody has property rights in the lake, or let's say fishing rights in the lake, suddenly there's an incentive to conserve and to keep it clean and so forth. Eventually, one of the big things we're going to have to look at, and I got a couple of chapters in the space book on this, is property rights in space. We already have quasi-property rights in terms of where people can put satellites and the line of sight and so forth. But that's something that seriously, to progress, eventually we're going to have to address the issue of property rights, because it's property rights that makes a free market economy work. And eventually it's going to be property rights in space that that really opens space up.
One of the reasons, by the way, we chose a suborbital flight for 100 kilometers altitude is that it has little to no debris risk. I mean, when you're popping up to 100 kilometers, you're only up there for literally at the apogee for a few seconds before you come down, and any of the debris at that altitude is pretty much swept by the remaining portions of the thin upper reaches of the atmosphere.
Talking this hour about space travel, privatization of space on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow talking with Neil Bilton, Neil Milburn, and Edward Hudgens.
Neil.
Thank you. I can get that. I need a drink. About the space travel. And is there no opportunity for possible collaboration with the government on a project that they might want? Let's say my pet project this is my pet idea. Tell me how this might work.
Okay.
Let's say you want, astronomers are always talking about having radio telescopes that are, you know, being interfered with by cell phones, things like this. They talk about putting a giant radio telescope on the backside of the moon. I'm sure you've heard about it.
Mm-hmm.
Why not some public-private project where someone would pay for the telescope part, like the NSF or somebody who funds these sorts of things, and private industry would help with the cost of getting to the moon and helping build the space station that you would need and putting people there, and selling the rights for the video, let's say, to one of the cable channels, so they could continually, you know, use that as an entertainment value. Does that have any sort of sound business sense there anywhere?
Well, I think it does. By the way, I did a piece on Astronomy Day, and if you go to the Objectivist Center website, www.objectivistcenter.org, under our op-ed, you'll find that op-ed. I'm an amateur astronomer, and I have a great interest in seeing exactly that kind of thing happen. I think the first thing that NASA can do, and this is one of the things that is being looked at, is contract out for services. For example, in the 1920s and 30s, the post office, rather than hiring pilots and purchasing airplanes, simply contracted out to people like Charles Lindbergh, who was a private guy with a private plane, to carry the mail. And so one of the things the government, NASA, can do more of is simply contract out for launch services and every other kind of service. Consortia of universities, and if the government has to be involved, the government could do exactly what you're talking about. By the way, remember, the two biggest observatories in the country for many, many years, the Mount Wilson Observatory and then later the Mount Palomar Observatory, were all privately funded by the Carnegie Foundation and then the Rockefeller Foundation. The Keck Observatory in Hawaii was about 80%, I think, privately funded. But even if government has to get involved, I'd rather be it on basic research. And yes, do it in cooperation with the private sector because, hey, they're going to be the ones who can probably do it cheaper.
You know, the paid zero issue here, Ira and Ed, as you guys know, is the cost of launching into space. You know, it's been literally $10,000 a pound for the last 40 years, and we've got to solve that. You know, we made the analogy earlier about the PC revolution. Remember that PCs, I mean, were room-sized computers owned by the government, and there was a, you know, this old adage that Watson, the chairman of IBM, said, well, maybe there's a world marketplace for four, you know, computers out there. And that was, in fact, the case until a few guys in a garage up in Northern California came up with Apple, and you see the IBM PC. An industry was made that allowed all of us to benefit from it. So volume is the issue. Today, if you look at the launch rate, commercial launches last year were 22 commercial launches of private vehicles into space. This year it's predicted to be somewhere in the neighborhood of 12 to 14. That's not an industry. You know, there are 12 to 14 launches out of Minden Airport, where I just was with Greg and Eric getting our soaring license, you know, every hour. It's something which we have to change, and the only large marketplace isn't hunks of metal. It's what I call, you know, self-loading carbon payloads that come with their own money.
And by the way, I mean, and Peter's got exactly the right analogy. At the Kennedy Space Center, you know, there might be three to four shuttle launches a year. And now with the shuttle explosion, there's going to be less than that, unfortunately. I want Kennedy Space Center to look more like Orlando International Airport, you know, where you have thousands of takeoffs. Now, it's going to be a while before we get there. But again, I think it's the volume and it's allowing this new market, for example, for tourism and so forth, to emerge that is going to do that.
And so you think that if you privatize the space shuttle and
stop right there. Page zero. It's not privatizing the space shuttle. The space shuttle is an amazing machine, and the people at NASA who operate
it
are the
most dedicated
in the world.
Well, we have a little disagreement. There's a little bit of disagreement on that, but we're coming up to a break, so let me take the break, and we'll come back and talk lots more about how we might deal with that. So stay with us. We'll be right back talking more with Pia Diamandis, the chairman of the XPRIZE Foundation, Ed Hutchins, author of Space, the Free Market Frontier. So stay with us. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the privatization of space with my guest, Edward Hutchins, our editor of the book Space, the Free Market Frontier, published by the Cato Institute, Peter Diamandis, chairman and president of the XPRIZE Foundation, located in St. Louis, Missouri. Before we go to my next guest, I want to just clear up this thing about the shuttle, because I know you have a little different view of how to use the space shuttle.
If I can continue where I was, the space shuttle, as I said, it's a 30-year-old machine. It's operated privately, it's owned by the government, and it's controlled in terms of when it launches and what it does by the government. It's somewhere arguably between $500 million and $1 billion a launch. An expensive ticket to space because it launches so infrequently. And because it requires literally 10,000 people to watch over it to make sure it's safe, the cost is completely inflexible. You know, the price of the fuel for the space shuttle is only a few percent of the total price. What we really need is vehicles designed from the beginning for us. You know, this tremendous payload of the future. You know, tourists, travelers, business people, explorers, private folks. You know, if you want to go and scuba dive, you can go and explore the oceans. If you want to mountain climb, you can do that. And you know, since I was nine, my passion has been, can I go and do this on my own? So we need new vehicles.
Yeah. By the way, I would say that I think Peter is right in the sense that the growth of the industry is going to come from the private sector. What NASA can do is keep out of the way, and where it still is in existence, it can make different kinds of choices. For example, if it does have to choose a next-generation launch vehicle, it should look for one that at least can evolve more than the shuttle has. And I know that Dr. Buzz Aldrin, who walked on the moon, is actually working on this kind of a design. But they also have to look at contracting out and things like this. And by the way,
and
Congressional
I agree with you there.
Right. Yeah, by the way, Congressional Quarterly, David Mashey has just published a very good overview of the current sort of situation at NASA and some on exactly some of these issues, so you all might want to check up the
Let me bring in another voice on this. Andrean is here. She's the founder of Cosmos Studios and the collaborator and wife of the late Carl Sagan, and they authored a half a dozen books. You know them. They co-created the movie Contact, co-produced the PBS series Cosmos, and she's the program director for the Planetary Society's solar sail mission called Cosmos One. Welcome back to Science Friday, Annie.
So good to be here,
Ira. Tell us a little bit. First, you've been listening in on this. What is your take on privatization of space?
Well, there's much that's been said that I agree with, and I'm a big fan of the Cato Institute's position on changing national drug policy, which I find to be very destructive and costly. But I really don't believe in the tragedy of the commons. I think it's a fiction. I think that for most of human history, we were hunter-gatherers, and the whole planet was our commons. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a much greater tragedy of the greedy than there is a tragedy of the commons. So I'd like to take issue with that. NASA has done a series of epical, mythic, brilliant achievements that were done by people who I suspect were not in it for the money. Mm-hmm. The people, the scientists, the space engineers who I'm working with on our solar sail, they would pay to do this. And so I would much rather see NASA actually having an active all-on solar sail program like the one that Cosmos Studios and the Planetary Society has. But they don't, so that's why we're doing it.
Tell us a little about it, because it is a privately financed
project. So
by the way, Anne, I do plug it in the book.
Oh, great. Thank you, Peter. Thank you.
Tell us about what's coming up.
Okay, so later this summer, the Planetary Society, Cosmos Studios, will launch the first solar sail in history. It's our way of commemorating the 100th anniversary of the Wright brothers' achievement at Kitty Hawk. And a solar sail is a conventional payload that will be put atop a Russian intercontinental ballistic missile, which is based in a submarine in the Barents Sea. Submarine is just below the surface. The rocket will break the surface. And once it gets into Earth orbit, this conventional payload will open up like some great mylar flower, 70 feet across. Highly reflective, a naked eye object for all of us on Earth, day and night, to be able to see it. And what's so cool about it is that solar sailing is a physically practical way to move through the cosmos 10 times faster than any spacecraft ever devised by humans.
So it's powered by the force of the sun.
Photons
from the sun.
It takes the photons from the sun in its great reflective sail, just as a sailboat on Earth uses a sail to catch the wind.
Or the way the solar wind pushes out the tail of a comet.
Precisely.
Mm-hmm. And so how far is this going to travel?
Well, we'll be happy. And, you know, the Wright brothers were aloft for 12 seconds at Kitty Hawk, so we'll be very happy if we can prove scientifically that it's deployed properly and it's actually been lifted and moved by light from the sun. So anything beyond that is great, but this could be aloft weeks or even months.
So it's not an X Prize candidate. You're not going to get somebody hang gliding off of this.
No, but perhaps someday. That's the idea.
And so this is going to happen. Do we have a launch date on this?
Late August, early September.
You have to wait on the rocket availability of that.
Yes, we had a suborbital test in July of 2001, and we had a third stage separation failure, which was
I hate it when that happens.
Oh, no, I found it thrilling to go around saying I had a third stage separation failure. It was like really, it was really exciting. But that was a problem of the launch vehicle, not the spacecraft itself.
I'm sorry, go ahead, gentlemen. You want to jump in?
I was going to say, this is a wonderful example of what can happen once access to space gets down. I mean, imagine, if you would, where you don't have to spend your money on launch costs, and where people, instead of endowing a new wing of a museum, are literally endowing exploration missions to go out to the planets. You'll have the first group of people who want to privately go and colonize the moon or go to Mars or build a colony. Those things are possible. You know, we had that over the last millennia, as we went to the New World, and that's going to happen again.
Did you have any politics you had to go through for this? Any hurdles, those sorts of things?
Lewis Friedman, who's the mission director and right. who really wrote the textbook on solar sailing in the 1970s and who's the director of the Planetary Society, had to acquire all of the permits from the Treasury Department and the Department of State in order to make it possible. But my understanding was that it was fairly smooth sailing.
So to speak. And it's done on the cheap, not an expensive thing?
It's less than $4 million. And so we at Cosmo Studios felt that we were being given an opportunity to outfit the Wright Brothers bicycle shop for roughly the equivalent amount of money.
See, now here's the thing. Couldn't you get a sponsor to put their name on the sale and then have them pay for something like that?
Yes. In fact, yes, you can do that. And we will have our own name and the Planetary Society's name on it. And perhaps there'll be another party's name on it. We'll see. But, we haven't found it that easy to monetize. It's more taking a place in history. It's also a kind of a little win for the species if it's survives.
Why is that so hard? I would think with entertainment industry the way it is, people love to have.
The
Nikes are these people like that who put their names on everything.
You would think
spend $110 million on a high school senior, or something.
Radio Shack did a commercial in space.
We have, if I could add, sure. St. Louis ended up being our major sponsor. When we kicked this thing off, there have been a series of business leaders in St. Louis, from Andy Taylor to John McDonald to the city itself, who have supported what we've done. And it really has come from what Anya was saying earlier. It comes from their belief in the goodness of human exploration and so forth.
That's right.
Corporations today have they want it quick. They want low risk. And space is something which is still somewhat risky, but it has the potential for a global audience and to really be a clutter buster if someone has the vision as a corporation. We're still looking for our title sponsor for the X Prize.
Let me just jump in and remind everybody that I'm Ira Flatow, and we're talking about the privatization of space this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Go ahead.
Right. Yeah, this is Ed. Ed again from the Objectivist Center. And while I disagree a little bit with your characterization of greed, I think you are exactly on the money when you say that what really motivates people is the whole challenge of doing something like this, of doing something what I consider great and inspiring. And I'm hoping that that's what people take away from this. And I do hope that they see that the private sector can emerge as the agent that eventually does exactly these kinds of things. And by the way, I'll make sure that we send you a copy of the Cato book where we plug you, okay?
Oh, great. I'd love to have it. I enjoy having it. And yes, I agree with you, Ed, that it is inspirational to be part of an enterprise which does something great. There's another dimension, and that is, what kind of positive dream of the future are we giving our kids? When I was growing up,
absolutely,
it was like the whole world, the future. No one would be poor. Everyone would be wearing these great little Mylar dresses and have, and it was the Jetsons. And now, all we have is a kind of a vision of dread, of terrorism, of environmental depredation as a result of the way we misuse our science and our technology. The solar sail is a dream, is a way, an existence theorem, an example of what you could do if we were to use our genius and our resources to do something positive.
And I think that philosophical vision is so important.
Which goes back to the issue of humanity sowing its seeds and backing up the biosphere, in essence, opening at the frontier. I go and speak at schools today and ask how many kids want to fly into space, and they'll raise their hands, and I ask, how many of you think you will have a chance to go? And very few do.
That's it.
Because over the last 40 years, why should they be interested in something they don't feel they have an option to do?
That's right.
So we have to change that.
But it's also, it's also at this point still a dangerous place to be. Mm-hmm.
So is the Earth.
I'm not going to argue with that. So is walking across the street.
Ira, we fly in airplanes today, literally crisscrossing the nation, booking on our cell phone in the taxi cab and being upset if our luggage is 30 minutes late. But, we have that privilege because people took the risk 100 years ago. And this is a frontier. We have to remember this is a frontier, and we have to be allowed to take the risk. And people should be allowed to take the risk in something they believe in deeply.
Right. By the way, if I can plug Carl Sagan's book, Contact, There is a great passage in the early part of the book, and many of you hopefully have seen the movie, where the lead character, Ellie, talks about being a little girl lying on the ground looking at the stars and just how filled with awe and inspiration she was, and how, and it follows up by saying that she figured out that she could actually understand what was up there. And I call to your attention that book is a great read, but also that has exactly that kind of spirit of wanting to understand and being able to figure out creating a Ruby Maser measuring device for a telescope and how you can do it.
Do you think, I only about 30 seconds left, do you think this 100th anniversary year of the Wright brothers is a good time to refocus on being explorers again?
I really do. I think that what the Wright brothers accomplished is so inspiring and so transcendent. And I think that absolutely it's exactly that.
Gentlemen?
It is happening right now. I guarantee you there will be a winner of the XPRIZE in the next 12 months.
You do? You're that confident?
I'm that confident seeing what the teams are doing. I think also want to let people know that, you know, the things you can do today before flying into space. I have a company called Zero Gravity Corporation. We're going to be offering commercial parabolic flights in a 727. Here in the United States, you can go to Russia and fly MiG jets with Space Adventures. There are lots of things you can do today safely. And you can even, for, you know, $20 million, you can, hopefully in the next year and a half, buy a ticket to go fly back up to ISS.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that having the 100th anniversary of flight is going to call a lot of people's attention to what has been done, what human beings can do now, have done in the past, and can do in the future. And I hope that this is not only a reflection on our technology and on the need to deregulate and do all the things that we've just talked about here, but on the limitless potential of the human mind and of human beings.
Well, Annie, good luck on your launch this summer.
Thank you, Ira.
And we'll be watching. I'll thank my guest, Andrian, is the founder and CEO of Cosmos Studios. She is the program director for the Planetary Society's solar sail mission called Cosmos One, which will be visible from the
Naked Eye, the world over, day and night.
We'll be watching. Peter Diamandis is the chairman and president of the XPRIZE Foundation in St. Louis, Missouri. Edward Hudgens is the editor of the book Space, the Free Market Frontier, published by the Cato Institute. He's an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute and the Washington director of the Objectivist Center.
Center. Go to our website.
And I welcome folks also to the XPRIZE website at xprize.org to learn about these
teams. If you miss any of those, they're on sciencefriday.com's website, so in case you want to track them all in one spot. Our program is produced by Annette Heist, senior producer Karen Vergoth. Charles Berkowitz is our web producer and our director. Our intern is Adrian McDonald, and we had help today from Brian Bayhuth in Reno. As I say, if you missed any of the links we talk about or any of the links that our guests are talking about, you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. They're all there. Also, you can also leave us email there, and you can listen to Science Friday's Kids Connection, free to students and teachers. We have curriculum we make out of Science Friday programming, so you'll be able to bring that into your classroom with you. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.